I suppose we ought to make a start, being hoping that Max or someone to I might go out and have a look around to see if Max or something. He might be in the bar. See what I talk about. People might be in the bar. They might have got no further than that. I think we ought to make a start now. It's 14 minutes past 7. Without more ado, I'll hand over to Stephen Bennie, who's going to talk on the Second World War, how we lost an empire, and how we won the war but lost an empire. And then I'll hand it over to Stephen.
Actually, I'm going to talk about British foreign policy in the first half of the 20th century. Even when I was a schoolboy, I remember, I was puzzled by the reaction to the two wars. The general reaction to the First World War was that this was pretty well a bad thing, mud, stuck in trenches. But the Second World War, which in fact was far worse, far more people got killed, is regarded in a sort of heroic light. And this was what I thought as a schoolboy. And then I became interested in classical liberalism, and then I learned that in the First World War we had such things as rent control and licensing laws which were brought in between 1914 and 1918, and they weren't got rid of for a very, very long time after it. I think council housing may have had its start in the First World War. And then the Second World War was followed by the Attlee government, which I regard as the most disastrous government of the 20th century in this country, and laid the groundwork for so much that went wrong in the post-war world in Britain. So that was further ammunition, really, for me, as regards the two world wars. There have been a few British historians who've queried the heroic interpretation of the Second World War. Charmley wrote a biography of Churchill, and in which he pointed out that the Second World War was disastrous for Britain's status in the world and led to immense amount of state control subsequent to the Second World War. A.J.P. Taylor also wrote some books which questioned British foreign policy, but he was regarded as a bit of a maverick. But this fellow has published a book recently. This is Churchill, Hitler and the Necessary War by Pat Buchanan. I should say Pat, and he called it How Britain Lost Its Empire and the West Lost the World. Pat Buchanan is an American journalist, politician. He's by no means a libertarian. He's a conservative. You know, you say with a small C, he's I think they call him paleoconservative in America, but he's in favour of such things as immigration controls, tariffs, I believe, is in favour of. But on one thing, he's pretty rock solid, and that is a non-interventionist foreign policy. So this talk really is it's a review of this book, which is a very good book, and I'd recommend you all to buy it. And it's a very good read. He's a good writer of English. And a few editions of my own. The book starts off actually with this quite bold statement: all about us we can see clearly now that the West is passing away. And that's the first line virtually of the book. You might be thinking, you know, well, he's going to talk about falling birth rates in the West, or mass immigration from the Third World, or the coming decline of Western economic power vis-à-vis Asia. But it's none of that. He's concentrating on the foreign policies of the great European powers and the USA since 1900. And in particular, he wants to know why two world wars broke out in the first half of the 20th century, wars which Buchanan thinks dealt a mortal blow to Western civilization. In this book, he's got a special role for Britain. He thinks Britain played the major role in the disasters of the first half of the 20th century, and he said because of its empire the UK turned both European wars into world wars. If Britain had not declared war in 1914, then Canada, South Africa, Australia, New Zealand and India would not have joined the World War I. It's also doubtful if Japan and the USA would have taken part. If the UK had stayed out, Germany would have been rapidly victorious, and as Buchanan maintains, there'd been no Lenin, no Stalin, no Versailles, no Hitler, and no Holocaust. And ditto for the Second World War, really. If Britain hadn't given the guarantee to Poland in 1913, then the Dominions and the USA would have stayed out of World War II, and the German-Polish War would never have lasted 6 years and cost 50 million lives. Of course, all this stuff is music to my ears, really. You know, I've thought similar things to this for a long time, and it's good that someone has put it so eloquently, a bit paradoxically, that it's American, really. There's a quote here which Roy Denman, who wrote a book called
Missed Opportunities,
which again is about Britain's role in Europe and the world in the 20th century. And he makes this statement. He said, at the beginning of the 20th century, Britain, as the centre of the biggest empire in the world, was at the zenith of her power and glory. Britain approached the end as a minor power, bereft of empire. On the world stage, Britain will end the century little more important than Switzerland. It will have been the biggest secular decline in power and influence since 17th century Spain. So really, if you're an imperialist or an anti-imperialist, if you're a defender or a skeptic of British involvement in the two world wars, you can recognize that what Denman's saying is pretty close to the truth. And that should give pause for thought. But Buchanan has one other point, by the way, in the perhaps it's his major point as an American, and that is this Churchill cult, which has grown in America. I do remember Churchill said about 1946 or 47, he said he could see Britain was declining, and he said, I wouldn't like to be leader of Britain anymore, really. You know, the place to be the boss is in the US. That's where that's where he thought he could rattle his sabre the best. But there is the Churchill cult which has risen amongst America's elite. So you get things like the Balkan crisis, and Slobodan Milosevic becomes the Hitler of the Balkans. And then you've got the Saddam Hussein in Iraq, who becomes an Arab Hitler about to threaten the world with weapons of mass destruction. And this Churchill cult, Buchanan thinks, leads to the bombing of Serbia, which had never threatened the US, and to the invasion of Iraq, which was not going to threaten the US. And Buchanan also sees that this Churchill cult is a recipe for future wars. One of these wars, he thinks, may well do to the US what the two world wars had done for Britain. I'll look at the Buchanan book in a little bit more detail now. And we can wind back to just before 1900. And first of all, you've got to, I mean, it's fairly obvious, really, you've got to realize that you can't have an isolationist foreign policy running alongside an empire. I mean, that's not on. Because if you've got an empire, you're continually running up against jurisdictions of other states. My view of the best liberal state, if you like, would be somewhere like Switzerland or Sweden, who mind their own business and they don't go trotting around the world organising this and threatening that, and as a consequence endangering their own citizens. But Britain wasn't in that position, of course, in the close of the 19th century, and a number of things happened to change British policy. At that point, Britain had this policy of splendid isolation, which was no entangling alliances. And they probably got some impetus for this from people like Cobden, the classical liberals of the 19th century. But it's very difficult to run that sort of policy and keep an empire at the same time. And a number of things happened, as I said, at the end of the 19th. One was in 1895, Britain received a virtual ultimatum from the US Secretary of State to accept US arbitration in a dispute between Venezuela and British Guiana, and that was a shock at the time. And then the following year, the Kaiser sent President Kruger a congratulatory telegram after the Boers in South Africa captured the Jameson raiders, and this caused a huge storm at the time. How dare the Kaiser have the cheek to interfere in what's regarded as a British business. The following year, the Russian fleet steamed into the Chinese harbour of Port Arthur and obliged the British warships to vacate the area. Lord Salisbury, the British Prime Minister at the time, remarked, "I don't think we carry enough guns to fight them and the French together." He was very, 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 he lamented that, really. The following year, 1898, the British and French troops clashed at Fashoda. That was a place in Africa where the two empires, there was continually tension over the colonial empires between the major powers. And this brought France and Britain to the brink of war. And most important of all was the Boer War, which began in 1899, which the British, it's really, I would have thought, if we go back from Iraq, which is a disgraceful example of a naked aggression, we have to go back to the Boer War for something similar. And of course the rest of the world saw it as such. And the US and the whole of Europe were completely opposed to the Boer War, and Britain was completely isolated. And the Kaiser remarked, "Britain's without a friend in the world," and he was absolutely right. And Salisbury did a number of things to deal with this. He pursued a policy of reconciliation with the Americans. They sided with the Americans in the dispute against Spain in the War of 1898. They gave the US the sole rights to build, operate, and fortify a canal across the Panama Canal, of course. And historians have generally regarded this shift by the British as one of the cleverest things they did diplomatically, switching the poor relations which Britain and America had in the 19th century to the generally good relations which Britain had in the 20th century. Then Salisbury turned to Asia and again did something quite sensible and signed a treaty with the Japanese. This treaty was such that each power agreed to remain neutral if the other was engaged in an Asian war with one other power. So it was on the back of this treaty, by the way, that the Japanese inflicted defeat on the Imperial Russia in 1905. But Britain's main rival in Asia had been brought under control by this. And the final thing, the most important thing, which is particularly relevant to this talk, is that in 1904 they signed the Entente Cordiale with France, settling a whole load of colonial disagreements, and then they followed that in 1907 by signing an agreement with Russia doing a similar thing. You have to remember that Britain and France and Britain and Russia were colonial rivals at the time, and there were various incidents of tension. Britain wasn't a colonial rival with Germany. And it's a little bit, you know, it's a little bit curious if you think about it, if you see the colonial rivals as causing wars. In fact, it was Germany that Britain went to war with in 1914 and not the colonial rivals. And this finally completed the lineup for World War I. On one side you had Germany, Austria and Italy, although Italy, of course, at the last minute stayed neutral and then switched to the Allies. And on the other side you had the Franco-Russian alliance backed by Britain, which was also allied to Japan. One good point, and that is that a lot of people in Britain saw the treaties with France and Russia as just a matter of settling colonial disputes and nothing more. It was Edward Grey, the foreign minister, who saw them as something more, as a way of taking Britain into European affairs. He said at one point, He said the threat of a German dominated Europe outweighed the damage of war. So if we are engaged in war, we shall suffer, but little more than we shall suffer if we stand aside, which of course is absolutely wrong. He was the one who gradually, slowly, took Britain into European affairs. When I was reading this book, a curious parallel occurred to me, and that it's pretty critical of British foreign policy before 1914, and doesn't say that much, this is Buchanan by the way, it doesn't say much about German foreign policy. But of course, if anything, German foreign policy before 1914 is a bit like British foreign policy before 1939, sorry. It's really an exercise in how to lose friends and alienate people, as far as I can see. And the Germans under Bismarck had made great pains to keep France isolated. Bismarck recognized France as being the main danger to Germany. And he had a treaty with the Russians, which as soon as he was, as soon as Bismarck was kicked out by the Kaiser, the Germans allowed to lapse, so that the French and Russians immediately formed an alliance in 1892, which Bismarck would, I don't think, ever allowed, had been the worst to stop. And then, more important still, was, from the German point of view, that England should have remained neutral. That was the critical, thing for the Germans. And what did they do before 1914? They started a naval race with the British. The craziest thing, the one thing that would be guaranteed to annoy Britain. And, you know, they use all sorts of arguments, such as we can have as big a navy as the British, and we've got a merchant marine which has to be protected. But that was the one, I think, probably the single stupidest thing the Germans did, which drove the English and worried the English so much that they went into the First World War. So, yes, Buchanan points out all sorts of flaws in British foreign policy, but it seems that the big failure was the Germans before 1914. If you actually look at German war aims before 1914, they're not so terrible, you know. They weren't a direct threat to Britain. They wanted to reduce Russian power in Eastern Europe, and they wanted the creation of, a Central European Customs Union, which is pretty well what we have today. This is not something that Britain should have been afraid of. And certainly, can you really see, if the Germans had won, would it have been worth 900,000 troops from Britain and the colonies? If we assume a German victory in the First World War, there would have been resentful enemies in France and Russia, and Germany would naturally have been allied with Poland and formed a bulwark against Russia. And again, that wouldn't have been obviously detrimental to British interests. You have a curious thing. All classical liberals know that we all lose from we all lose economically from war. But the curious thing is that, as far as I can see, the British lost strategically as well. So that after the First World War, Britain was in the strategically worse position than she had been before 1914. And the whole question of Eastern Europe pops up continually in British policy. All of this was made clear, really, I think, at the Versailles Treaty, where the Germans lost one-tenth of the population and one-eighth of the territory. All the Germans' overseas empire was confiscated. And by the way, this is a little tidbit for libertarians. All the private property of German citizens in the German colonies was declared forfeit, which was a little bit unusual. The size of the German army was strictly limited, and the German fleets, both military and merchant fleets, were seized. A bill of 32 billion gold marks was set as reparations. And then finally, under Article 231 of the treaty, Germany was to accept full responsibility for causing the war and all the damage resulting. This last article was regarded as ludicrous. Denman again makes a sort of a useful analogy. Says these terms are difficult to bring home to British readers, but supposing that Britain had lost the U-boat war in 1917 and Germany had imposed an equivalent peace, it could have meant British recognition that its policy of encirclement had caused the war, confiscation of British colonies and the British fleet, Dover and Portsmouth occupied, the Royal Navy reduced to half a dozen destroyers, South East England demilitarised, Liverpool a free port with the corridor under German rule to Harwich, crippling reparations, and as Denman points out, no post-war British government would have accepted this, and no German government, whether it was under the Weimar Republic or under the Third Reich, was going to accept this either. And this is the result, really, of the first. This is what we get out of the First World War. A complete disaster. I have to admit that I was under the influence for a long time of my. You might say luckily, I had a schoolmaster who was actually interested in his subject. That's a rarity, isn't it? But I had a historian schoolmaster who was interested in his subject. And he had the view that wars don't start anything new, particularly. They just accelerate trends which are already in existence. And I think I've been under the influence of that. But the First World War didn't do that, did it? It destroyed whole traditions. I mean, I think you can make a strong case that prior to the First World War, there is a tradition towards liberalism, a movement from autocracy to liberal democracy. In Russia, I believe you had the Duma formed in 1912, I believe, which was an embryonic parliament. And I think there is this trend, and of course that's completely destroyed, and the Bolsheviks take power. In Germany, you have the Weimar Republic, which is unsteady because it's having to accept the Versailles Treaty, and eventually falls to National Socialism. In Italy, very shortly after the First World War, you have Mussolini marching on Rome. And it really does look like it altered things very much for the worse and set up new trends. Rather, I don't think the things I've described would have happened without the First World War, let's put it that way. If we get back to Britain now, it looked at superficially as if the British Empire had come out of Versailles as the great winner. The Hohenzollerns, the German royal family, the Romanovs, the Habsburg, the Ottomans, they're all wiped out by the First World War. But the British Empire had grown by almost a million square miles. Buchanan actually gives an amusing example. He said in 1920, a man could have walked from Kuwait to Cairo, turned south and walked all the way to Cape Town, and he'd never have left British territory, a British colony or a protectorate at any point. And of course lots of Americans thought this was disgraceful, that the war had been fought for to extend the British Empire. But behind these superficial gains, there was the number of casualties of that Britain had suffered during the First World War. This was almost a million, and other countries had suffered worse, of course. The originator of the Imperial War Graves Commission, a fellow called Sir Fabian Ware, he calculated that if the dead were to march abreast down Whitehall, the parade past the cenotaph would have lasted for 3.5 days. Another factor was, of course, that all wars cause huge debts, and British debt was 14 times what it had been in 1914. So when you're looking at the future, about defending all these huge imperial gains, you have to realise they can't afford it. And then there's the whole moral question, that Britain and other European powers were forming these empires supposedly to teach good government to the natives. But of course, after the Europeans have spent 4 years butchering each other right, left and centre, how are they going to assert their right to govern other people wisely? It looks a bit paradoxical there. And then, at the end of the war, you had the various sermons by President Wilson about self-determination. And one of the things about Versailles is that all the countries of Europe are supposed to gain national self-determination. And but was this idea of self-determination to be applicable only to the German, Austro-Hungarian and Ottoman empires? Are they the only ones who which are going to be broken up? Balfour, for instance, had promised the Jews a homeland in Palestine. Lawrence of Arabia stirred up Arab nationalism to defeat the Turks. And by the time Lloyd George, the British Prime Minister, came back from Versailles, revolt had broken out in Ireland, and there were rebellions in Egypt, Iraq, and India. He was awarded, by the way, he was awarded the Order of Merit by George V, and he quit back. We're going to have to do this whole thing over again in 25 years, at three times the cost. I disagreed a bit with Buchanan on his views about German foreign policy before the First World War. But he's absolutely on the nail when it comes to Britain in the interwar years. You have to remember that by 1921, Russia had gone Bolshevik and was antagonistic to all the capitalist countries, so it wasn't going to be an ally or a reluctant ally, only a reluctant ally of anybody in the West. And the Americans are also completely disillusioned with the war and the Treaty of Versailles. Buchanan, in fact, writes, he's an American nationalist, said, "So the Senate never did a better day's work than when it rejected the Treaty of Versailles and refused to enter the League of Nations." And that's what they did. The Americans didn't even ratify Versailles, and they didn't join the League of Nations. They weren't going to give thousands of lives so the British could, and the European powers could, add to their imperial gains. So Britain's position was much more strategically perilous in the immediate aftermath. So Russia had gone, America had become isolationist, but they still had Japan. The curious thing then is that the Australian Prime Minister Billy Hughes, who was quite a sensible fellow, had wondered how the British colonies in Asia would have fared if Japan had been neutral or a German ally in World War I. And the answer to that is pretty obvious. And it would seem fairly clear that Britain had to keep the Japanese as allies. But they did exactly the opposite. They went to a conference in Washington in 1922, and they agreed with the Americans that they would ditch the Japanese and they would turn to a four-party treaty by which America, Britain, France and Japan would agree to settle their disputes by peaceful diplomacy. And of course the Japanese were very miffed by this. And the absolute result of the conference, apart from the fine words, was that Japan was no longer an ally of Britain and was had been turned from an ally to a possible predator. Billy Hughes, the Australian Premier, said, "You propose a substitute for the Anglo-Japanese alliance and overwhelming power of the British Navy, a Washington conference." And that's precisely what they did. And the result was, 20 years later, the Japanese, of course, sided again with the Germans against the British and wiped out the British Empire in the East, occupied it with absurd ease. And this is one of the curious things, that the discussion of British foreign policy is covered really in just purely moral terms in the interwar years. You know, we should have done this, stop Hitler or stop the Japanese or whatever. And little attention is paid to the fact that if you want to prevent other countries doing things, you have to have allies and power to prevent them from doing it. And the same trick which they'd worked with the Japanese in 1922, they did again with Italy in the 1930s. When Hitler first came to power, actually, Mussolini, it sounds a little bit strange to people now, was rather unimpressed by him. He considered him a buffoon. After their first meeting in Venice, he called Hitler a clown. And then after the Night of the Long Knives and the murder of the Austrian Chancellor Dollfuss by the Austrian National Socialist, Mussolini exclaimed, he said, "Hitler is the murderer of Dollfuss, a horrible sexual degenerate, a dangerous fool." And he also thought that National Socialism wasn't as nice as the fascism. He had this sort of view. And also behind this, he wanted to see an independent Austria. So again, you had a position where Britain had a potential ally. And remember, after the Italian unification, which the Britain had helped the Italians with in various ways, I think they ferried Garibaldi's troops across the into Italy. There was a good feeling between Italy and Britain still, so there was, here again was a perfect opportunity to form an alliance. And indeed, in 1935, the Germans made this the first open break with Versailles, and they said that they were going to introduce conscription and have an army of 400,000 men. At Versailles, the Germans had been limited to an army of 100,000. So this was actually the first open break by the Germans of the Versailles provisions. And the leaders of Britain, France and Italy, they met at an Italian town of Stresa and formed something which is called the Stresa Front. And they affirmed the independence of Austria. And of course, this is something that Mussolini initially wanted. He was happy to have a small independent state on the other side of the Brenner Pass. And he thought that a hard line with someone like Hitler was necessary. But immediately after this front was formed, Britain, behind the backs of the Italians and the French, signed a naval agreement with the Germans, which limited the German navy to a certain size, but they didn't consult either France or Italy. So, the French and Italians saw this as another example of perfidious Albion. And you know, how can we trust this country when it cuts a deal with Hitler behind our backs? And the second, and perhaps the most important demolition of the Stresa was the Abyssinian crisis. I don't really want to go into the details of this particularly. Mussolini wanted his place in the sun. You know, that was the thing at the time. And was Britain in a place to criticise this? Buchanan tells a story of how a Frenchwoman told Churchill that Italy was only doing in Ethiopia what Britain had practiced for centuries. Churchill replied, "Ah, but you see, all that belongs to the unregenerate past. It's locked away in the limbo of the old wicked days. The world progresses." Well, of course, this is exactly the wrong approach to take towards the Italians, and Britain led the campaign in the League of Nations to impose sanctions on Italy. But they messed about and didn't impose the one sanction which might have affected Mussolini, and that was an oil embargo. So they just fiddled and faddled, and the result was, of course, they lost the Italians, and that didn't affect the Italian campaign in Abyssinia. And then 6 months later, when Hitler reoccupied the Rhineland, Britain and France turned to Italy for support. Will you help us here? And of course, Mussolini said, of course not, what's the point of that? You're just doing all that you can to destroy me in Africa. So between 1922 and 35, Britain had severed its alliance with Japan, it reduced the strength of the Royal Navy, and needlessly antagonised Italy, as David McDonough described it, as a hat-trick of home goals. So that is the background of this policy of appeasement that is described. In other words, Britain was, by these stupid actions, much weaker than it needed to be. And the policy of appeasement was a result, if you like, of, I think they realised simply that Britain was in no way as strong before 1939 as it was before 1914 as regards allies. The final act in this tragedy, really, call it that, occurred in the spring of 1939. British opinion actually changed towards Germany over the winter of 1938-39. They'd been keen on Munich, but the two things happened. One thing was the so-called Kristallnacht, which is when Nazi stormtroopers went on the rampage looting Jewish shops and burning synagogues. And that changed British public opinion. And then the other thing was the Germans marching into Bohemia and Moravia, which is now what's now known as the Czech Republic, in 1939, which was Henry Kissinger regarded as a quite stupid thing for Hitler to do. And on the back of that, Chamberlain rose in the House of Commons and said, "I now have to inform the House that in the event of any action which clearly threatened Polish independence, and which the Polish accordingly considered it vital to resist with their national forces, His Majesty's government would feel themselves bound at once to lend the Polish government all support in their power. They have given the Polish government an assurance to that effect." And that, what that meant was really that the UK was now committed to fight for Poland. It had reversed its traditional policy, at least in European policy, of staying out of things, because it realised it wasn't particularly powerful there. And it had given Poland a guarantee, and really it was up to the Poles to decide when and if this guarantee would be taken up. It was a bit of a one-sided guarantee, you know, there's nothing that Poland could do to reciprocate this guarantee by Chamberlain. And of course when it came to a dispute on something like Danzig, which he did eventually, the Poles knew that all they had to do was dig in their heels and call out the British Grenadiers to fight for Poland. Denman in his book sees the guarantee to Poland as the fatal blunder that leads to the collapse of the British Empire. He said the fear that after Poland Hitler would have attacked Britain was an illusion. As he had already made clear in Mein Kampf, Hitler would have marched against Russia. As it was, Britain was dragged into an unnecessary war which cost nearly 400,000 dead, bankruptcy, and the dissolution of the British Empire. The alternative was plainly to rearm. Hitler wasn't to be trusted. And if anything, Britain and its ally France at the time should have encouraged Hitler to gone east. As an American writer, Hanson Baldwin, said, "There's no doubt whatsoever that it would be in the interest of Britain, the United States, and the world to encourage the world's two great dictatorships to fight each other to a frazzle. It would have placed the democracies in supreme power in the world, instead of elevating one totalitarianism at the expense of the other, the democracy." Because we have to remember that the result of the Second World War was the crushing of Hitler, because Stalin and Soviet Russia was brought into a position of dominance over Eastern Europe. The fight, the final stages are a bit almost typical, really, because given that you've had the Polish guarantee, the only sensible thing for Britain to do then would have been to negotiate an alliance with the Soviet Union. But they fiddled and faddled and messed around throughout the summer of 39 and didn't do it. And then the Nazi-Soviet Pact of August 39 was really checkmate for the whole of British foreign policy at that period. And Hitler surely must have thought, well, that's it, the British can't be so stupid as now to declare war once they realise that Poland has got Germany on one side and Russia on the other. It's just such a silly thing to do. But of course, that's precisely what Britain did. Buchanan actually makes an interesting quote here. It was Kitchener in 1920 who said, "No one can say that my colleagues in the cabinet are not courageous. They have no army, and they declared war against the mightiest nation in the world." Well, it's even more true in 1939. Britain's army was minimal, and certainly couldn't do anything to defend Poland against either Soviet Union or Germany. So the upshot of it is that in this country there's still a lot of talk about Britain resisting Germany alone in 1940, but this book explains really why the UK came to such a position. And it wasn't just the German victories in 1940 which isolated Britain, it was the result of the policy pursued in the 20s and 30s which put Britain in such a difficult and dangerous position. And if Hitler had been a bit more astute, you can't doubt that he would have won that war. I mean, he did so many stupid things. I mean, for instance, why did he declare war on the USA? No one has really come to a sensible answer to that. But someone, it looks like he is going to come up with a sense of that. So I think I'll finish. I'll finish at that point.
Is there anything for anyone who has to speak? You must try to answer that question, for example, like...
I won't answer the question, but you can go ahead and answer the question why Hitler declared war on the US.
Oh, I think he's convinced...
I have other questions to ask.
I'll answer it in a nutshell. I think Hitler was convinced of two things. One, that Britain was very, very strong, potentially, because of the empire, and that America was very, very weak. Those were two false ideas that Britain had, that Hitler had in his mind.
It doesn't answer really the question why he was not stupid to declare war on America, because adding even a weak power to a strong one doesn't seem to be very clever, even if he believed that the US was weak. But no, I think that I've read Buchanan's book, and I think it's a very good book, and I agree with most of what he said. And I mean, 1914 was a suicide of Western civilization. When you think that we had, before 1914, that we had the Latin Union, which was like a gold standard, but the same currency, with the same gold pieces. You know, like today, when you travel across Europe, you have euro coins. And if you look at these euro coins, for instance, that you get in Paris, you see that some of them are, sort of coined in Germany, others in Spain, others in Italy, and so on. You can see it. So that is what happened in Europe back in 1914 with the Latin Union. But and so on, free trade, you had it was developing, you had free movement of people across Europe, except in Russia, the only country where you had to have a passport to travel and so on. But I think what you've missed and what Buchanan missed is a constant in UK politics to prevent the emergence of a big power on the continent. Napoleon, then Germany, and so on. And even the European Union. I mean, when suddenly the British realized that the European Union was real, they entered, you know, they joined it in order to derail it, which they did. I mean, you know, rather than having six countries politically unified, they wanted to be part of it in order to have all sorts of other countries joining it and diluting it to the point of, you know, it was just free trade zone and nothing more. Whereas, I think the really the position of the UK is to be an extended possession or dominion of the United States, as Hawaii is in the Pacific, UK is in the Atlantic. And this is what it has become. You know, the poodle of you know, the United States and so on. So they missed on both counts. In other words, they managed to create a mess in Europe, two world wars and so on, and nonetheless ended up being a dominion of the US. Comment and object.
No, I mean, I agree that has been a traditional aim of British foreign policy. They fought against Philip of Spain, Napoleon, and the German World First War to stop a major power dominating Europe. But of course, the business about America doesn't affect British policy, does it really, in 1914 and 1939? You know, that's come along later, the subservience to the US. I don't dispute that. I think that's what happened. I mean, Buchanan just says he didn't think it was wise for Britain to go into the First World War to pursue this aim. And I think he's simply saying that what would a Germany dominant in Europe have meant? And he doesn't think that the Germans dominating Europe, which would have meant a bastion against the Russians, it would have meant a common European common market in 1914 or 50 years ahead of time. He doesn't think that that is anything like as bad as what happened. And you're quite right what you said at the beginning, that I hadn't thought, I might have done actually, that coming off the gold standard. Yes, I mean, that's that is a good point. There are lots of things went wrong with the First World War, and that's apart from Bolshevism and National Socialism and various socialism. But coming off the gold standard, of course, is yet another important factor.
An immense one.
Yes. We lost sound money.
But of course the French, in between 1870 and 1914, were absolutely obsessed with regaining Alsace-Lorraine, which was one of these absurdities that some you know, countries suddenly developed, and a kind of obsession with getting something. And they, of course, you know, first the alliance with Russia and all these sort of things. And that's, you know, one.
You can perhaps enlighten me here, actually. This is just me asking you a question. You're French, aren't you? I thought the Germans in 1870, they only took part of Lorraine, which was the Moselle. You know, not the whole of the Lorraine. I mean, maybe you know that. And of course Alsace. But I mean, this is just, we're looking at political power politics there. I mean, the French took Alsace in 1648, didn't they? They'd been German for 800 years. Okay, and the French took it in 1648 and said, well, right, that's ours now and we've got to keep it, you know?
Mm.
I went to Alsace once and I don't know any French, but I speak a bit German, and I chatted with the locals there in German. They still speak German, you know?
No, they do, yes, absolutely. Mm. Well, they yeah. And yes, you're right, it's only part of Lorraine that became German Republic. So it was not, but, you know, they referred to it as a Lorraine, but it was only a part of Lorraine. But it was the whole of Alsace. Sorry, I don't want to.
Does anyone else want to speak?
Yeah, well, it's a pretty wide subject, sort of back in detail, because you've covered a lot of ground, you know.
Yes, I did.
It's a wide sweep, but make one or two points, maybe. German colonists. German Tanganyika, South Africa, and Germany was certainly looking for more colonies before World War I.
Yes, I think they wanted the French colonies.
The successful German colonial ambitions that it brought to. I think another general point is that the British Empire was in overripe decay before the end of the 19th century, before the World War came up. It was overextended. The British state had taken over the running of India from the East India Company, which would be a disaster.
Yes.
And foreign policy then was instead of using trade as a means of building the empire, had some land to do, as we'll find out at the time, became a question of coaling bases, really. A place like Aden was taken over by invasion, up by force, and so on, all the way around Africa, across other places, not all of them, but so I think that's the major mistake. The empire was on the way out anyway.
Yeah, but I would say this power would make two points. Because I'm not an imperialist, so I don't have much sympathy with empires. But in the 19th and 20th and 30s, one of the vowed aims of the British Foreign Policy is to maintain the empire. You know, that is what they're doing. And as far as I can see, the policy they pursued was that which would place the empire in most danger. You know, the dissolution of the alliance with Japan, which meant the Asian Empire was in danger, India and Hong Kong and all these other places out there, even Australia, I guess. And then the antagonism of Italy, who were the most important power in the Mediterranean, and Britain, to maintain its empire, had to control the Mediterranean, had to control the various oceans. So they antagonized the Japanese, and then they antagonized the Italians, which was just as silly as you can be if you want to maintain the empire. But I agree with you, you know, the empire would have declined, but as Buchanan says in the book, you know, after the Second World War we didn't see a gradual decline, did we, which is what we could well have seen, but we saw a complete collapse. As soon as the Second World War was, I mean, after the First World War, Ireland's gone. After the Second World War, India's gone in rapid style. They've driven out of what's now Israel by the Jewish terrorists there. And by the middle of the 1950s, Macmillan has made a direct policy, that they're going to disengage from empires. And that was within, 12 years after the Second World War. They couldn't maintain it, you know.
Well, Japan, as you said, they were trying to get closer to America. So America has been anti-Japan for years, had been anti-Japan at all. And so therefore, part of the deal was that American naval power be used in the Pacific, and would be more in the Atlantic. There was some sort of agreement. I don't know the details of it. And so Japan didn't like it, didn't do anything about it for a while. And then we came up to the Smoot-Hawley tariff business, and all around the world tariffs were erected against trade. Now the one thing about Japan is that more than any other major country is dependent on trade so that it can buy food. There's no way the Japanese can feed their own people. They have to trade. And so the tariff barriers which were put up affected the Japanese more than anything else. Which probably helped the decision to go and invade Manchuria and mess around in China as they did. Of course, the West didn't like the idea of Japan having colonies, and so America slapped sanctions on Japan on top of the tariff barriers. And all of that began stopping Japanese ships from searching them. And then, of course, the final straw was when they embargoed oil and began preventing Japan getting oil. Now, that is like throttling a country. That is absolutely killing it. It's like murder. Murder, dental murder, were really in touch with self-defense. Now, I'm not saying that their response was terribly brilliant, but on the other hand, it's a reason. But that's how Japan ended up on the wrong side in World War II.
I mean, one thing I didn't really cover as much as I should have in the talk was that there was this doctrine which had strong support during this time, that small countries couldn't survive. So you had to be like Russia or the US or Britain with an empire, and Hitler subscribed to it, that you've got to have somewhere where you can, as you talked with John, somewhere where you can feed your people, and that's the reason why he wanted this push against the Soviet Union to control the Ukraine, which he regarded as being a breadbasket for the German people. You know, he thought the Bolsheviks, which he thought were absolutely feeble and weak, had been almost sent along to save the Germans, if you like. So that all he had to do, as he said, when he invaded Russia, was he'd just kick the door down and the whole thing would just fall down. And ditto with the Japanese, I think they thought that they would occupy the mainland of China to ensure this food supply. You know, as a small nation, they thought they couldn't survive without without land. Because it's quite wrong. And it's a doctrine which led to tremendous wars. But
Before I think you're wrong about the land, I mean, Japan is mostly rice. It's true they have fish. And in order to have any rice supplied at all, they have to pay the farmers 6 pounds a world price of rice to get some rice grown at all. Mm. Well, that's by no means a talking amount of treatment.
But the
Japan. So in Japan, it's a particular case.
Well, Britain isn't that far away, is it? Britain's a small country. We have to trade to feed a 60 million population at a living standard, you know. I mean, not... All right, Japan, the population of Japan is double the UK, I believe, isn't it? So that's one thing.
Yes.
And, that's an Japan's an extreme example, but we're an example. Well, look, you know...
That's the example we're talking about, Japan.
Yeah.
Why did Japan go on for one side and World War II?
Well, I mean, because they'd invaded mainland China, to pursue this doctrine, you know, that we must have land in order to feed ourselves.
Yeah, but it's a bit odd because, I mean, since 1895, Japan had Taiwan, which we had annexed from China. Then, after 1905, they had taken, and in 1905-1912, they had taken Korea, Manchuria, and so they had an interland, a colonial sort of empire, which they could develop. And of course, in the 1933-34 period, there was a big power struggle inside Japan between a party that wanted to invade Siberia and a party that wanted war with China. And unfortunately, it is a party that wanted war with China, knowing that it would mean the United States would not sit quietly. That won. Whereas if the party that wanted war with Siberia had won, or with Russia had won, probably the United States would have said, well, why not? After all, you know, communists, we can get rid of the communism and so on. So, but they already had an empire. Plus they had the islands, not much, but I mean that they had taken over from Germany at their side.
So there was a 1937 war, wasn't there, with Japan and the USSR, and the USSR won it in 1937. Most people overlooked that war. But actually, Noam Chomsky in the 1969 book, which I haven't read since 1969, I think it has, had that sort of thesis that American Power and the New Mandarin, the book was called, that the America bullied Japan into war.
Yeah.
Well, what happened, I mean, it's not really germane to what I was talking about. What happened was that the Americans were opposed to, as Christian said, opposed to the Japanese policy in China. And in 1940, I believe, they placed sanctions on Japan, forbidding the import of various things like oil and steel and critical goods from the US and from, I think, Britain and from the Dutch East Indies, I believe. And the Japanese regarded this as a declaration of war.
Yeah. Which, in a way, it was.
Richard.
If we're to change the panel, do you think there are any lessons
current war in Afghanistan?
I don't think there are any major lessons. No, I think war is a really disastrous. But despite everything, I do think the you know, you can overdo these they're like old colonial wars, aren't they? I mean, they are silly, but they're nothing like the First World War or the Second World War for their impact on societies. I think the First World War really is the one that gives a tremendous impetus to anti-liberal forces in Europe.
And nationalism.
Yep.
And nationalism, yeah.
Because of the Wilson doctrine and things like that. And when you say that, you know, small countries could not survive, that was the idea at the time. What their side did, and the other treaties on their side, they broke up the Austro-Hungarian Empire, which was very viable, and so they left France, that had been, you know, completely ruined by the war, with 1,700,000 dead, and an economy that was, you know, bankrupt. Russia had sort of disappeared with its civil war and so on. The Austro-Hungarian Empire was broken up in many small countries. So Germany remained with 80 million people right in the middle and almost left with praise all around it.
Yeah,
so it was the most absurd you know, treaty that you could imagine. A very angered, very resentful Germany and no real power to be a counterpower.
All these countries in Europe got national self-determination at the Versailles, or most of them did, but what they also got is that their fate was going to be determined by either Germany or the Soviet Union.
Yes.
Because they were too weak, as you say, after the collapse of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, to defend themselves. And this is how Britain and France get sucked into the Eastern European disputes after Versailles.
And then, under Versailles' own ideology, it was perfectly legitimate for Germany to claim the Sudet that were populated by Germans, ethnic Germans, and Danzig, that had been a German city, I mean, you know, the city of Schopenhauer and so on. So it was, you know, what could you say against taking the Sudet and against taking Danzig?
Indeed. Kennan, actually, I didn't quote this. Kennan wrote, George Kennan, who was the guy behind the
long
policy of containment after the, wouldn't call him a libertarian, but he's very sensible, like Buchanan on foreign policy. And he wanted America to pursue this policy of containment, which is far better than the doctrine of running the world.
Mm.
And he just said today, if he was writing this in 1950, by the way, he says today, if when we're offered the chance of having back again the Germany of 1913, a Germany run by a conservative but relatively moderate people, no Nazis, no communists, a vigorous Germany, united and occupied, able to play a part in bouncing off Russian power in Europe, it would not sound so bad in comparison with the problems of today.
And these empires, I mean, the Austro-Hungarian Empire and the Ottoman Empire, were pretty much liberal in terms of ethnic sort of discrimination and things like that. I mean, the Austro-Hungarian Empire was actually run more by Hungarians than by Austrians, and the Ottoman Empire was, you know, completely multi-ethnic. Like, in a bit, it was. In a way, it was more multi-ethnic than Switzerland, which has these cantons to, you know, keep people apart and so on. The
why was Germany left untouched with Versailles and the Ottoman?
Germany wasn't left untouched.
It was cut in two.
The Germans, of course, the French got back Alsace-Lorraine. But more important for the Germans were that the Germans lost a lot of land in Eastern Europe, and what was Eastern Prussia was split from Germany by this Polish corridor. And in fact, Poland didn't exist before 1914. So lots and lots of land was lost by the Germans.
Mm.
And lots of areas which had been traditionally German for hundreds and hundreds of years were put under control of various Eastern. And that actually rankled more with the Germans than Alsace-Lorraine. And all the German governments after 1920 wanted to revise the Versailles settlements in Eastern Europe. Under the Weimar Republic, they'd agreed to do this peacefully. Hitler had the same aims, it wasn't going to hang around. Didn't it?
Well, it was, I mean, we lost Memel, which was given to the newly formed country of Lithuania, and Memel was populated by Germans. But of course, the corridor was really the absurdity. It was just a humiliation to Germany. And it was given to Poland because the Poles had some illusion that you had to have access to the sea, which, why do you need access to the sea? So Czechoslovakia didn't have access to the sea, Switzerland didn't have access to the sea, Hungary didn't have access to the sea, all these newly formed countries didn't have access to the sea. But the Poles said, oh, we want access to the sea. And in another way, in another insulting way to Germany, they said, we'll give you Danzig. You know, told the Poles, we'll give you Danzig. German city, never had a Pole.
95% population was German.
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely crazy. Any more questions?
Yeah. Britain's still a liberal country in the 1930s, really. Do you think it would have been a reasonable foreign policy to try and provoke a war between Germany and Russia?
I don't think they had Britain had to do any provoking.
No, well, Denman says that it would have been a good idea. I'm just wondering if you agree with
it. You know, I think that was a natural tendency of events, and the curiosity about British foreign policy is we got the war between Germany and Russia eventually, but the British foreign policy up to 1913 deflected for a time Hitler away from the aim of invading the Soviet Union to invading the West, invading France and other countries in the West. You know, Britain didn't have to do anything, that was the thing.
Well, that's not what Denman said,
is it? What did Denman
want? Well, you quoted Denman earlier saying that he thought Britain should have tried to work a war between Germany and Russia.
I think this American historian said that the world should have allowed and indeed have encouraged the world's two great dictatorships to fight each other to a France war. But I mean, I don't think there's any need for any encouragement. Also, I mean, Hitler wanted a war with the Soviet Union. He thought that the Soviet Union was incredibly feeble and would collapse, and that then he could get his Lebensraum.
like that, so that we were suddenly allied against
Palmerston said, you know, we have no friends, we have only interests. But I think the point was that, as was mentioned earlier, Britain tended to want to prevent one country from dominating mainland Europe.
Well,
and that country had been around about 1800 being France, and then the perception was that in 1900 this was Germany now, which was, after all, the biggest country, the largest population in. I mean, the main.
What's the population?
About 70 million, I think.
Yeah. Almost 80 million. It was twice the population of France at the time.
In
1914.
1914.
Yes, that's right. So it was twice the French population and more than the British population. So it was, you know, it would have dominated Europe.
Because, I mean, Britain's population was in 1945 was 40 million.
Yes, I mean, Britain's population is about the same as France at the time, wasn't it? About 40 million, 45 million, something like that.
I think
what Buchanan is saying is that the effects of the intervention there, which did result in the defeat of Germany, would have been far worse than a victory for Germany, really, a short victory for Germany. I mean, that's the point. And certainly it's far worse for people who have our views and want to see things like the gold standard and no rent control and
when you look at the similarities between two, for example, the British Royal Family, the Junior Royal Family were related, and the dissimilarities with the French, for example, it is hard to reconcile how these alliances.
The British Royal Family, you know, Victoria's children had married into, had married all around all the royal heads of Europe. You know, they were certainly Germany's.
Russia was
another one. I think there were various other royal families. So really, we couldn't run a foreign policy on.
I mean, that's just one of the many sort of interactions from Britain, Germany. It just seems hard to reconcile how this the triple entente came around. I don't know if this book dwells on some of the other things of how this treaty came around. I don't know if it dwells on that.
I think it was the beginning by Grey and the British leaders. Although I say that the entente occurred in the Conservative government, but the I think there must have been a general policy that we're going to dig in against the Germans, and at the same time we can use these agreements to settle colonial disputes which Britain had with France and Britain had with Russia.
One of the stories I've heard about, and I don't know if anyone else here, but it was quite common about 50 years ago, and that was the British government was being blackmailed by the French government about some of the royal goings on with the royal family in Paris.
But do you find that far more convincing than the explanation that was given by Christian and, you know, the balance of power? I mean, if you follow the balance of power thing, the fact that Germany becomes stronger means that it automatically takes over from France as the power that's to be undone on the continent. So, I mean, originally it was Spain, of course. Britain was concerned with Spain before it was concerned with France.
I'm not so sure.
Because it was the number one power.
Was Germany the number one power? I mean, if you look at the Austro-Hungarian Empire,
it was the number one industrial power.
It was, yeah. Industrial-wise, yes. But I still find it difficult to see how it was perceived as an enemy. As compared to the Russia, which occupied more than half of Europe, I think, at the time. But it still says some of Russian territory.
I think it was perceived as an enemy because
the Austro-Hungarian.
You know, it was the power that could dominate Western Europe. I think it's as simple as that, and that's how they saw it. and they didn't look any further than that, and we have to be ready to prevent that happening.
It does seem that everyone was spoiling for a fight, dancing. It's easy to overlook that now, but in the early parts of the war, I mean, even Hitler himself was keen to join up. So were the Celts over here as well, although a few years into the war, they had more than enough.
I get the impression that In Democracies was a popular for about 9 months.
But I mean, given nationalism, you've always got the stage set for a war. You know, this is what nationalism basically is. You're the nation's the group. I mean, Stephen Miller used to wear a badge which used to when he used to play chess, and he used to, the glory of the nation is war. And people used to misread it. He was running down the state, but they thought he was eulogising war.
Yes, I was wondering what was the impact of war on the loss of liberal ideas, and more specifically, is it the war that led to the loss of liberal ideas, or is it because the liberal ideas were losing ground at the end of the war?
Well, my old schoolmaster would have said the second, that liberal ideas were in retreat, and that may have been so to some degree, but I gave example. One is without the war, would Bolshevism have taken over in Russia? I mean, there's an obvious. I mean, you may have got more socialism, but it could have been parliamentary socialism. But what you ended up with in Russia, Italy, Germany, was one party totalitarian state. And you get democracy, liberal democracies still in Britain, France, and the Scandinavian countries, and Holland, I guess. Is that right? Spain, of course, also. I forgot about Spain. Spain also goes fascist.
Portugal, Salazar,
yeah. I mean, there is.
Have you seen that as a result of the war?
Well, it looks like it, doesn't it? You know, in 1922, Mussolini marches into Rome. 1917, the Bolsheviks take over. The Weimar Republic is extremely precarious. There are putschers in 1923, and finally it goes under in 1933, and no one seems to be sad about it in Germany, as far as I can see. You
could argue that, like, these points that you're making is facts, like a manifestation of more sort of general developments, like in the turn of the 19th century. I mean, the thesis by Karl Fernandez, a great transformation, for example, like one of the things you talked about earlier, we mentioned, was, for example, like the gold standard, the schism that put through, like, Europe, and the effect it would have, as people sort of, reaching the sort of, I was going to say that it might be, just quickly to sort of turn our attention to the one specific point where they say the gold standard. And if you have a country like Germany that's doing particularly well, from 1870 to 1914, what effect would that have, on the gold standard with respect to the other countries, in Europe?
What effect?
Yeah.
I don't see any. You mean deleterious effect? I don't see why there should be any deleterious effect. I mean, they're still trading, but they're just using gold as their reserve currency. And it was a very solid reserve currency. And obviously, it, given the situation today, far better than fiat money, isn't it? No doubt about it. Am I free?
Thank you.